Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of the You Should Run podcast. I'm your host, Tony Heil, council member from Bridgeport, Pennsylvania, which is near Philadelphia. And if you've listened to my podcast, you might know a little bit about my personal political history, which includes campaign work, obviously running for office as well. But my first campaigns were out in Iowa, and I have a special affinity for Iowa and Iowans. I will always remember the kindness of people in the state, and also the interesting politics that exist there. And I actually spent time in Council Bluffs, Iowa, and even Sioux City, which is now the area where Steve King is congressman. And I was there when he first got elected, but now I might be talking to the person who may be finally defeating him in an election. And he's got a terrific story to share about his motivations for running, his vision for Iowa, and hopefully while you should be encouraged to run too, particularly in elections that may be difficult. So before I get into this, make sure to follow the podcast on iTunes or your favorite service, including Spotify. Share this, leave comments, and hopefully after you listen to my guest today, you will be excited to participate as well. And with that in mind, let me welcome J.D. Scholten from Iowa on the podcast. Hello, J.D.
Hey, Tony. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, so this is an interesting time for all of us. I am sitting at home while my kids are finally being quiet as we're quarantined. But, you know, so I imagine for someone like you, you're running, you're thinking about, well, I might run to change the tax code a little bit or improve this somewhat or this or that. This is a daunting situation for anyone who's staring into the abyss of governing, huh?
This is definitely something very unique, and we're just trying to take this day by day and trying to adjust accordingly. We are working on a couple of virtual town halls, and then also trying to do set up a virtual fundraiser as well, because we had a couple bigger fundraisers at the end of the quarter here cancel. So it's a very unique time for everything.
Yeah, and this week, as this is happening, a number of members of Congress have even been diagnosed or have talked about being in contact with people who've been diagnosed with coronavirus. So it's a trying time for the country and the world. But that doesn't shake you, right? You are just as committed as ever to running for office.
Well, I mean, this is exactly why I'm running for office. My mother was a public health director for decades, and she spent the last 20 years preparing for this moment. And so I've really had a lot of great conversations with her talking about what it means to have public health and global health and how we're all in this together and the steps that need to be done. And so, I view this, especially right now, it's so important to have leaders and just people who, in time of crisis, you really see people's true colors. And one of the things that I always like to say, I used to play minor league baseball, and so I say I don't care where my shortstop came from, if he was from Delaware, Puerto Rico, or Texas. I don't care who my left fielder voted for. We all worked together for a common goal back then, and I feel that's a lot that's missing in Congress. And then not to harp on my opponent, but like, he's posting memes on Facebook that are conspiracy theory and just nuts and just bashing Democrats. And I mean, that's not leadership. That's I don't know what you want to call it, but it's not helpful in these times of crisis where people, there's so much uncertainty and people have a lot of questions right now.
And, you know, I think everything gets wrapped up into partisanship. You, especially in the kind of district you're running, you can't be running a specifically partisan campaign. But on the one hand, you see governors like Governor Mike DeWine of Ohio and Governor Cuomo from New York, from two different parties, two different ideologies, who seem to be taking this coronavirus issue very seriously. And then you do have people, you know, honestly, including the president with some of the things he's posting and talking about you know, are just dishonest. And it's frustrating because this should be a time when it doesn't really matter if you're Republican or Democrat. You can come up with a conservative or liberal approach to it, but you need to just be straight with the facts and honest.
Exactly. That's exactly it. It's interesting. I mean, this district is pretty conservative these days. King traditionally wins by 20. We moved the needle last time. Trump won this district by 27, but we ended up losing by 3 in 2018. And we got 25,000 more votes than there are even registered Democrats in the district. And so I'm not going to say I have all the answers, but I think what we were able to do was really connect with a lot of people. And so I feel that not only, like, is it the right thing to do, like, on our social media right now, and what we're, our messaging right now is about leadership and about where people can get information, but I also feel like that it's people are looking towards us at this time as well.
So that brings us to the fact that you have run in 2018. This is a district that is, like you said, very conservative. And it, to me, the definition of conservative has changed since my first got into politics. You know, it seems like, yes, there are liberal conservative things, but what is a Republican and Democrat doesn't even seem the same as it was when I first got involved. But you got involved in running in 2018. What was the thing that really pushed you to say, I got to do this?
You know, it was the 2016 election that just was a gut punch to a lot of people. And at the time, I was actually living in Seattle. And I saw what happened in the nation, and I saw what happened here in Iowa. And I wanted to make a difference, but I didn't know what that meant, or I didn't know how to do anything. I mean, I was working as a paralegal. Before that, I was a minor league baseball player. I wasn't in politics whatsoever. I was an active voter, and I followed the news, but that's about it. But growing up here in Iowa, we were blessed to have all these presidential candidates. So I got to be surrounded by politics, probably more so than the average voter. But what really hit home was I went to visit my grandma for Thanksgiving, and so several weeks after the election, and she wasn't doing well, and I was the last person to get her to eat. And the last thing she said before I had to fly out was, you need to move back to Iowa and take care of our farm. And our farm we rent out to a family friend, but it hit home because she passed away shortly after that. And at that rural church where she was an active member most of her life, that is where I did the hardest thing I ever had to do, was give her eulogy. And a month after that, I was still trying to search for things. And there was the inauguration happened, and the next day I went to the Seattle's Women's March, and I was just so blown away by the raw power and energy. I realized that moment I needed to make a difference. And there was an article that really changed my life a few years ago. It was in The Atlantic, and it said, life's not about the pursuit of happiness, it's about the pursuit of meaning. And I was happy in Seattle. I had a good job, good friends, played a lot of basketball and tennis, and just enjoyed life. But when I came back home, I immediately found my meaning, and it was getting more active. And then I looked in my hometown paper for a job, and the best job I could find was $15 an hour with no benefits. And I saw why my generation moved away, and just one thing led to another. And eventually nobody was in this race. And that's when I said, you know what? I got way out of my comfort shell, and I was like, I don't know if I could raise $5, but I think I could make a difference. And in a district where nobody thought I had a chance, I committed to getting out there to the people. We're 39 counties. We're pretty massive. We're the second most agriculture producing district in America. So very rural. And so I committed just driving around nonstop. And I put about 35,000 miles on my personal vehicle. And then Winnebago RVs are made in my district. So I bought a used one of those, threw a logo on the side, and we put another 25,000 miles on that. And we showed up in places where nobody's been in years, and people rewarded us, and we almost pulled off the upset, but we fell by 3 points, which was about 10,000 votes in a district where there's 70,000 more registered Republicans than Democrats. And so with all that energy, with all we were able to accomplish last time, I couldn't just let that just go to the wayside. And so we launched again this time, and now with King getting stripped of his committees for questioning when has white nationalism and white supremacy become a derogatory term, we really are feeling confident in if we execute our game plan, we can win this time.
Yeah, I remember when Steve King first got elected, and he seems to, from my distance point, be focused on an ideology and an outlook that isn't necessarily conducive to the interests of rural Iowa, especially with some of the issues I know you've talked about, like healthcare and poverty. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. I mean, he's pushing his, I call it at this point, his selfish rhetoric, because it's all about him. And we got 55,000 farmers right now with their backs against the wall. We have almost every gas station in this district has a donation box for someone who just got sick or someone who just got in the hospital.
And that was before the coronavirus.
Exactly. And so we have huge needs in this district, and it's getting harder and harder to live in rural Iowa and rural America. And yet we have a congressman who's not trying to, he's pushing his own ideology rather than doing the benefits of what this district needs.
And I think it's frustrating to see that as a constituent and as someone that obviously cares about good government. You know, I'm here in the Philadelphia area, and as things are challenging with a health situation, I know that there are many hospitals around me, to the point where I don't think about going to the doctor. I think about which doctor to go to or which hospital. I don't think about, you know, can I get to the store? I think of which one will I go to? And same with gas stations, same with this and that. The challenges in rural Iowa and rural America are very different, right? So, you know, what are the things that maybe voters like me from far away or elected officials even should recognize as we're developing policy that you see as important to rural Iowa?
Yeah, so one of the things, we just wrapped up a 39-county tour, calling it the Don't Forget About Us tour, and going into towns of under 1,000 people. And what we're seeing, half these tiny towns, these smaller towns, that used to have really strong communities, they're struggling to keep the local grocery store afloat. And some of these towns that, I don't know, 30 years ago may have multiple grocery stores, the only thing that left is a Dollar General. And we look at like the what that represents. And so Dollar General's coming in and they undercut the local grocery store by about 20 to 25% in sales right away. The grocer can't stay afloat, so they close. Dollar General doesn't sell fresh produce or fresh meats, and so then Dollar General also only offers their employees $8-9 an hour with little to no benefits. So they're going to the employees have to go on government subsidies to get some of the things they need. So then the money that goes to Dollar General goes to their headquarters or to go to Wall Street. And so we're sucking the wealth out of a lot of these communities. And that's probably the easiest way to show it is through companies like that and what's happening. And Walmart was the big scare and really changed the way rural America was about 10, 20 years ago. And now Dollar Generals are even shaping it even more so. And so you have all these small mom and pop businesses that are trying to do the right thing, are community based, and just running out. And in the meantime, Dollar General gets to have these huge tax breaks and all these subsidies, and then their employees have to go on these government subsidies. And it's one of those things that I don't think gets talked about enough. I pressed a lot of the presidential candidates on this, and it's something that it matters to a place like Philadelphia or around Philadelphia, because a lot of the food comes from here. And right. So if these communities aren't doing well, then it's clothes, it's energy, it's food, it's a lot of different things. And so that's one of my things on why I'm so passionate about fighting for rural America and why I ran originally, and then why we ran again. And I think a lot of our success and what we're trying to do stems from people understanding the need for change in this district.
Yeah, I think something you said there stuck out in terms of that this affects Philadelphia because, you know, with this disease that's going around and this pandemic, we realize the opportunities and the costs of the global interconnectedness, but we also have the national interconnectedness where, you know, if people in Philadelphia don't realize that we're connected to Iowa and Nebraska and Kansas, and people in Kansas and Iowa and Nebraska don't necessarily always think about how they're connected to New York and LA, and, you know, everyone's connected in the country in some way. So you've identified a problem and you're running for federal office. Like, what are some of the solutions that we can provide that you're hoping to gain some followers on to hopefully help these situations?
Well, this is one that I don't officially run on or anything, but like playing baseball was one of the best things for me because I had a common goal with so many people from different backgrounds. And I wish more people were exposed to something like that. So if we had some sort of national program where maybe a high school student from Philadelphia in between their junior and senior year can come out to Iowa for a summer or something like that, I would love to see a national program like that so we can figure out more of this interconnectedness and have more relatable conversations and so people understand where other people are coming from. But one of the biggest things that I'm pushing for is enforcing our antitrust laws, especially in agriculture. This is one thing I was being here in Iowa and having run against King and having some success about that. A lot of the presidential candidates came through here and had a lot of wonderful conversations. And I actually worked on about five or six of the presidential folks' rural policy when they rolled them out. And I pushed them all on enforcing our antitrust laws. We had this same battle 100 years ago. And as a result, we had the Stockyards and Packers Act. And basically that is there to protect farmers from monopolies. And right now, especially in the, well, it's all industries, but you look at in hogs, four companies own 60% of the market share. Chicken, I think about 71% that four companies own the market share. And in beef, it's four companies own 85%. Now, anything above 50 with four or less companies is considered a monopoly. Mm-hmm. And so what that means is these multinational corporations are dictating the inputs. So it costs a lot for farmers to whether it's seed, whether it's feed or equipment, prices are skyrocketing on that front. And then it dictates the market side on where a lot of these products go. And then it dictates how they're farming. And so, I mean, one thing, we're all on this planet together. If we're going to combat climate change, one of the first things we need to do is enforce our antitrust laws so we have more of a democratic say over how these lands are farmed rather than having these multinational corporations that are maximizing their profits and not really caring too much about the land. And that's one thing that I'm really trying to push folks outside this district and outside of Iowa, because we had the same battle 100 years ago. We had two Republican presidents. We had Teddy Roosevelt had 45 antitrust lawsuits. A lot of them dealt with agriculture. And then Taft followed that up by having 90 antitrust lawsuits during his term. And again, a lot of those dealt with agriculture.
You know, I don't think people realize the impact that agriculture has on climate change. I know you've talked about that, but you know, I look at states like, again, you look at the interconnectedness. States like Florida are going to depend on states like Iowa having a more fair agricultural system. Then,
exactly, and it's one of those things where I think farmers right now, again, they have their backs against the wall. If they have a chance to not become a contract employee in the not too distant of a future, this is the number one thing we need. Now, do we need more things than just enforcing our antitrust laws? Absolutely. But this is the first huge step. And it was amazing to me to see like all shades of blue in the presidential race, have this as part of their policy. And you had, I mean, you had people, you had Bernie, you had Warren, and you had Biden, and so it was cool to see that they all picked up on it. And the interesting thing is, the senior senator from Iowa, Chuck Grassley, he's talked about this for years. He just hasn't done much about it. but it's something I feel that can connect with folks in, across the aisle. I have a couple farmers who are I talk to on a regular basis, and they are not Democrats by any means. And they curse me up and down. They call me a socialist, all this stuff. But they know I'm darn right on this, and I got, I know I got one of their votes. I don't know if I got the dad's vote, but I'm pretty sure I got this son's vote. So it's one of those things I think can bridge some of the gaps in these difficult districts.
And the way you're presenting this, you're not talking about it in the same way that maybe your opponent would, in a xenophobic way, like, well, China's bad or this country's bad, but that the large corporate financial goals of farming and agriculture in general are the problem here, because it's, even if they were based in Maine or Philadelphia, it's the lack of concern for the sustainability that's the real issue.
Absolutely. Well, I think the number one issue that America has as far as the economy goes, and this is nothing to do with the current situation with the coronavirus. This is, I mean, it does, but this is pre all this, and we don't know where the economy is going to go and all that stuff. But the number one thing for years, DC has not figured out how globalization affects the working class. You know, how do we deal with globalization and with that affecting the middle class? And we need to deal with that. And nowhere is that more prevalent than in agriculture, where you look at all our trade policies, you look at a lot of the farm bill. It's meant for these multinational corporations, but it's not meant for the farmer. And so here's the crazy part. In this district, we have 39 counties. We have farmland as far as the eye can see. And we only have 2 farm-to-table restaurants.
Hmm.
And so
we have more than that right in my neighborhood.
there you go. And so when you only have 2 farm-to-table restaurants, grocery stores are closing, and Dollar General that doesn't sell fresh produce or fresh meats are coming in, and farmers aren't making a dime right now, you got to really look in the mirror and say, what are we doing this for? And who are we doing this for? And so one of the biggest things that I'm trying to propose is, for pennies on the dollar, create an alternative regional food hubs and an infrastructure with that. So farm to nursing home, farm to school, farm to community college, farm to prison, these networks. And we create where farmers who want to do something different than just corn or soybeans, and they can start doing food that we all can eat, and they feed off each other, and make it regional, make it local, and then we can build the infrastructure off of that and build the markets off of that. And we could easily do that for pennies on the dollar and what we're investing in agriculture right now. And so that's I mean, that's a huge opportunity to really, like, work with, like, for us, it'd be working with, like, Omaha's and Des Moines and the Sioux Falls. And I'm sure there's places out in your neck of the woods that would benefit from this program as well.
Yeah, and the way you talk about it and the way that things are going right now with quarantines, you know, if instead of a national problem as it is, if you could quarantine Sioux Falls or quarantine Omaha, for example, then you would still, you would just have this one spot that's cut off for a few weeks, and then the growth can continue. As opposed to everything needing to be shut down, it can kind of create a backstop, like you would in baseball.
Exactly. So.
And one thing also I've heard you talk about, and talk about passionately in many ways, is poverty. And I know poverty presents itself differently in your area than it does in Philadelphia. When people are talking about, you know, in the streets of Philadelphia, where they go to this homeless center, or they get this service or that service, and that's important, don't get me wrong, but it's a very different issue in how people see it in your area, right?
100%. I mean, it's especially in the rural communities, you don't see it. So you don't see the homeless person sleeping on the sidewalk in these places. It's really hidden. But one of the biggest things that we're seeing are what we call a lot of deaths of despair or diseases of despair. We see high alcoholism. We see high. We don't have as bad as opioids as other areas of the country, but we have bad a meth problem in some of these areas. Mm-hmm. Mental health. I mean, we're 51st in the nation. The state of Iowa is in mental health beds. And there's someone who's close to the campaign who has had a mental health, a crisis right now. And we've tried to get this person to go see a therapist. And the local therapist, it was a 2-month wait. And you hear more and more of these stories throughout the whole district. And, I mean, it goes hand in hand with the economy of the district. There's not a lot of hope. There's not a lot of jobs. And so, like, Democrats talk about raising the minimum wage, and I'm absolutely for that. But what my district desperately needs is that $60,000, $70,000, and $80,000 jobs.
Right.
And so one of the things that I was planning on doing, but we're, I mean, kind of in limbo right now with, we don't know what's happening with Corona and everything, but I was going to do a tour, a rural revitalization tour with Congressman Ro Khanna from Silicon Valley. And he was going to talk about the importance of technology in these communities. And I was going to talk about how, like, then agriculture is related to this and how these small communities can work together with technology for these communities to stay strong. And he's already worked on a pilot program in my district where it produces, in this small town, $60,000 to $70,000 tech jobs. It goes straight from high school, junior college, into working for this company. And so we like to joke that he's done more for the district in the past 6 months in creating jobs than King has done in 18 years, but I'm not here to bash King either.
Well, no, and I know you're trying to stay positive, but I can see, and I don't want to dwell on the negative, but clearly your outlook is, I can work with people, my opponent is incapable of working with people across the aisle, or even within his own party, and you're working with, you want to work with, you know, Chuck Grassley if you need to, or Abby Finkenauer, or, you know, you want to work with whomever you can, and you're willing to bridge those divides for solutions as opposed to just looking for scapegoats.
Exactly. I mean, it's what this district needs. It's what, you know, I had so many people come up to me after last cycle and said, you know what, you ran a great campaign, and I'm glad you didn't. Like, I could easily just bash King on saying all his racist rhetoric, all his just craziness and his conspiracy theory. But I wouldn't earn votes that way. And so we talked about what we're for, and we proudly talk about what we're for rather than just what we're against. And people rewarded us. I mean, folks, there's a lot of Republicans that came up to me when we launched and said, we're really glad you're running again. And that just, it shows that, you know, I came with this philosophy that if you get out there to the people, if you prove you're trustworthy and prove that you're going to fight for your constituents, you're going to earn votes. And that's what the people who've had success in this district as Democrats, and it might have been in the 80s when it was Harkin, Senator Harkin, but he was a congressman first, and then Berkeley Bedell. Those two are my heroes.
Yeah.
And they're not just like conservative Democrats that had success. They were back in the day. I mean, this is the prairie populism. This
right.
is where a lot of progressive ideas came out of from rural areas. And so it's interesting. I tell folks, you know, run as who you are. Don't run on trying to be something you're not, because people love, like, the authenticity. People love who you represent, because and if you can form it in a way of, like, why these things matter to the district and why they matter to you, people reward you for that rather than just blindly saying, oh, I'm for this or I'm for that, because that's what Democrats are, or that's what Republicans are for. So that's my one set of advice, I guess.
Well, Tom Harkin was definitely one of my first heroes when I got involved in politics, and I was proud to work on his campaign. And I remember when I was on that campaign, that was when Paul Wellstone died, and just seeing Senator Harkin collapse. And I don't think I've seen that level of pain from a death, from like personal, except for when my uncle died and my mom had to tell me, like, that, you know, that seriousness of what he was trying to do. So, like you said, people reward authenticity.
Absolutely. Wellstone was amazing. I encourage everyone to watch, there's on YouTube, Harkin's speech at Wellstone's funeral.
Yes.
Oh, man. It will give you chills. He did such a good job. And one of the, probably the things I'm most proud of in the last, since I launched, is Harkin and I have become friends. And I think the world of that man. And so I'm glad you got to see that. I'll say this. When I launched, people were asking about, like, I've never ran for anything before, so people were like, well, what do you stand for and all this? And one of the few things I talked about was, you know, in college I was training to play professional baseball, and so all fall I was going to different tryouts, I was going to different workouts and different things. And my one weekend I took off, I took on an all-night bus, I think it was about a 20-hour bus ride from Lincoln, Nebraska to D.C. to protest the potential war in Iraq in the fall of, it was October of 2002. And when we got off the bus, that's when the news, and I mean, back in the day, only on that bus, there might have been like two or three cell phones. This is pretty,
right.
I mean, 2002, not a lot of cell phones. And right when we got off, that's when we found out about the news of Wellstone, and people were just heartbroken.
And, you know, to bring it back to when I first started talking with you here, it's amazing that I was there, and, you know, paying attention, doing things in 2001, 2002, 2003. The position of being against the war in Iraq then sounded extreme to some people. And now the Republican president holds that position, whether he is sincere about it or not. And then he's able to take all the Republicans who are like, yeah, we were always opposed to that. What are you talking about?
That's exactly right. But that's the thing. I think politics are changing so fast. And it's interesting to me because it's changing fast and it's not. Like, there's for all the pundits that say Iowa is not on the presidential map, I think is ludicrous because in 2018, 52% of the people who voted for a federal race voted for a Dem. And as of right now, after the caucuses, we have more Democrats, registered Democrats, than we do registered Republicans in the state. And for them to say that it's off the map is nuts. And so, I don't know. I just feel there's a lot of people, and a lot of people who I think are in positions of decision making on some of these things that don't understand the time, and I think a huge part of it is they don't understand a lot of rural stuff. And I know, especially amongst Democrats, the sexy thing is to talk about Georgia, Texas, and Arizona, Nevada, and all that stuff. And what I'm trying to say is, you know what? We absolutely need to be there, but it shouldn't be either or. It
right.
Be a yes and. And so, what I view as what the nominee needs to do in order to win the presidency as a Democrat, I mean, you got to excite the base, you got to get youth, and you got to compete in rural areas. You may not have to win, but you have to compete. And I think that's one thing that the Obama coalition did so well that people don't talk enough about. In the 4th district, everyone says is the biggest conservative district, he competed. He almost won. And it was amazing to look at the data and what he was able to do in it, especially in 2012, in Woodbury County, he got 52% and King got 51%. So there had to have been Obama King voters. And that just, I mean, talk about scratching your head in politics.
Right. That I totally agree. And I think, especially with how things are going now, you see how important that would be. You need people. And again, people like me in Philadelphia need someone who's a champion for rural America for all of our benefit, not just for rural. It's not an either or situation.
Right. And I do talk about how, like, with Harkin not being there anymore, there's a huge voice missing.
Yes.
There's not enough rural Democrats. And I mean, I would love to see a lot more, but even just having some standing up, and there's certain issues that, like, would just, especially when it comes to anti-poverty and helping farmers out, even just a little bit, that voice is missing. And so that's a huge part of our message. We're trying to fill this void. And it's weird because we're running a very modern campaign, but at the same time, it's very retail and throwback to the I guess 80s and even maybe a little bit in the 70s as well.
Well, whether it is going door to door or going on a bus or being on Facebook and Twitter, politics is all about talking to people. So it's just, you're just changing the way you do it.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
So, well, and maybe you can get Senator Harkin to talk in the podcast. I'd love to talk to him sometime. That would be a dream come true.
I'll reach out to him.
That would be a bright spot in this crazy time, that's for sure. Well, with that in mind, I would really encourage everyone to follow JD on social media, especially on Twitter, see what's going on, and learn about rural campaigns, learn about rural America. We need candidates like JD running because it boosts up the turnout down ballot and up ballot. And like you said, you need to compete everywhere, right?
Yep, that's exactly right.
So do you have any last final words for telling people to encourage them if they're considering running for any office whatsoever?
Yes. But first, I will say that, yeah, you can follow me at JDSCHOLTEN. That's Instagram. That's all the social medias. And then our website is Scholten, SCHOLTEN, the number 4, and then IOWA.com. So ScholtenForIowa.com. But I'll tell everybody, you know, there's so many people, especially last cycle, I had so many people come up to me and said, you know, I would vote for you, but you were just a paralegal, as if it was so disrespectful, as saying that, like, my job wasn't good enough for whatever it is. That's hogwash. It doesn't matter who you are. This is a democracy. And so I challenge everyone, you know, I was so influenced by that article I mentioned previous that life's not about the pursuit of happiness. It's about a pursuit of meaning. If there's something meaningful in your life, and it may not be running for office, but if it is, I encourage so many people to do it. It's hard work. There's so many things I would do differently to start off than what I did. But at the same time, it was one of the most rewarding and things I've ever done in my life. I'm absolutely blessed with it, and I'm still I enjoy doing this today. It's one of the hardest jobs I've ever had to do, but at the same time, it's one of the most fulfilling. And I always tell folks, it's easy when it's in your heart. So with that, I just want to say thank you, Tony, for having me, and this has been great.
Well, I hope if it's within your heart, if you're listening to this, you'll consider not just voting, which is important, but running for office, whether it's for Congress, though hopefully not in Iowa 4, or it's for state legislature, mayor, council. Everything matters. There's 500,000 elected offices in this country, and we need more voices running for them, not less. Thank you so much, JD. It's been a real pleasure talking with you, and best of luck in everything you do.
Thank you, Tony. Have a great one.